I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today, who is John McCain? An angry man who used to hold his breath till he passed out as a toddler, or a moderate who hates war and forgives his captors? Or maybe both. We'll have a profile. But first, campus police have identified 27-year-old former grad student Stephen Kaczmierczyk as the gunman who opened fire in a classroom at Northern Illinois University yesterday afternoon, killing five students and wounding 15 others before killing himself. He had been an award-winning sociology undergraduate, but he'd recently gone off medications and legally purchased two of his four weapons just last week. School officials said they had a plan in place to prevent a Virginia Tech-type tragedy, that two officers were at the building in 30 seconds yesterday, eight more in the next minute and a half, to no avail. Here's Police Chief Don Grady.
The shooter walked into the building, managed to begin his shooting spree, and concluded before we actually were able to enter the building and stop it. It's an unfortunate set of circumstances that no one could possibly have predicted, nor could they have been more responsive in getting the event to stop. Unfortunately, these things happen.
This was the fifth shooting at a U.S. school in this past week. Joining us from DeKalb is USA Today reporter Judy Keen. Judy, did police say anything more about a motive or any more about Kaczmierczyk's mental history?
No, they in fact said they have no idea what the motive was. They found it, no note. They said that he did not speak in the lecture hall before he began shooting. But I think that NIU Police Chief Don Grady did give us a little hint when he said that the shooter had become somewhat erratic in the last couple of weeks after stopping taking his medication. The chief would not elaborate on what that medication was, but the fact that he emphasized it, I think, suggests, at least at this early point in the investigation, that perhaps that was a factor.
Oh, and, of course, it is so early in the investigation, we probably don't know the answer to this question, but are there questions about whether or not he could purchase guns legally with a mental health history?
In fact, the individual from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Chief Grady both indicated that the two weapons whose origins they have identified as having been purchased February 9th in Champaign, Illinois, were purchased legally. Mm-hmm. They're still investigating two additional handguns that were found on the scene. We learned today for the first time that the man had four weapons, not just three, as earlier reported.
Are officials at all connecting yesterday's shooting to some racist graffiti that we understand was found in a dorm bathroom last December, which referred to the Virginia Tech shooting?
The police chief was asked that question this morning, and he rather strongly indicated that he sees no linkage there. He said that that threat that you described from last December was not a credible threat. And he certainly did not say nor imply that they think these two events are connected.
No. Is anyone questioning the school response? We know the school was locked down within minutes. And since that graffiti incident, the faculty has been learning how to identify potentially troubled kids, prepare for emergencies. They did send out internet and email alerts. But we understand the school did not have a system to send text messages to cell phones. So are there any questions about that?
They did not have that kind of a system, which, as you know, many schools have implemented since the Virginia Tech shootings in April of last year. I spoke with many students on campus last night, just a couple of hours after the shootings happened, and none of them said that they were dissatisfied with the notifications. Mm-hmm. They all seemed to know that what they needed to do was to go to the campus website, and in fact, it looks as though updates were posted there very quickly. Mm-hmm. One student who was in his dorm room at the time of the shootings said that an announcement was made on the public address system in his dorm before he even knew what was going on, that told students that there was an emergency and that they should remain in their rooms. Mm-hmm. I also spoke with some parents who rushed to campus last night to pick up their children, and none of them were raising concerns about the security systems that were in place.
Well, Judy, we want to ask you about something that your paper is reporting. USA Today reports on the pro-gun group Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. They're having a rally in April to mark the one-year anniversary of the Virginia Tech shootings, and they're pushing for the ability to carry guns on campus, they say, to protect themselves. Now, 38 states and D.C. ban guns in schools. 16 of those states go further to ban guns at colleges and universities. We understand lawmakers in places like Virginia are sympathetic to these kids asking to be able to carry concealed weapons. Give us an update on moves to make that kind of legislation.
Illinois is not among the states that are currently debating that law, but this is clearly a reaction to the Virginia Tech shootings. And the sentiment of those who are supporting the measures is we have to give people a chance to defend themselves. I certainly expect that in the wake of these shootings, and they keep coming every few months, it seems, that this debate will intensify. Clearly, those who support allowing weapons on campus believe that, you know, there's nothing else that can be done. And we saw the response time yesterday at Northern Illinois University was pretty fast, but not fast enough to stop the guy. What if the teacher who had been on that stage had been armed? And I'm certain that this will become a focus of that debate going forward.
Yeah. USA Today reporter Judy Keene, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, fresh from an endorsement by once arch-rival Mitt Romney, Senator John McCain is campaigning in Wisconsin today, the all-but-presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency. It's quite a comeback for a campaign that just a few months ago was nearly broken and broken down, sagging in the polls, so short of money they had trouble paying for hotel rooms. So who is John McCain? Why is he ahead? And why does Rush Limbaugh say McCain will destroy the Republican Party if he does win the nomination? Of course, we're also going to profile the viable Democratic contenders, but today a profile of John McCain, and we do that with Evan Thomas, editor-at-large for Newsweek magazine. He's just written the magazine's cover story on John McCain. Evan, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
And right off the bat, you write in your article about language that it seems to us McCain is increasingly using on the campaign trail. I just want to listen. Here's Senator McCain speaking this past Tuesday after winning the primaries in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. And it's widely assumed he's addressing this at Barack Obama. Let's listen.
I don't seek the presidency on the presumption that I'm blessed with such personal greatness that history has anointed me to save my country in its hour of need. I seek the presidency with the humility of a man who cannot forget that my country saved me.
Evan, you write about John McCain's disdain for something he calls self-glory. What do you mean by that?
Well, McCain is one of the great self-deprecators of all time. I mean, he knows that he's a hero. And so that it gives him the opportunity that most of us lack to actually be humble. I mean, the most confident people are the most humble. And he learned the hard way in prison camp elements of grace and forgiveness that are remarkable. But he's clever, politically clever, about using this. It's I don't mean to be cynical about this, but it's convenient in a way. He can say I'm the humble one. I was rescued, reminding everybody that he's rescued because he was a war hero shot down in a prisoner of war camp, and I'm the one who believes in the human sin and redemption and all that. You know, the experienced, savvy one who's really been through the wars versus Obama, who hasn't done all that, is, you know, young and, you know, arguably naive and full of big talk, but hasn't suffered the way John McCain has.
Well, and there's no love lost between the two, dating back to a fight in Congress over ethics. That's a story for another day. But you say politically clever. You also use words like vindictive in the article, and also very complimentary words. So let's paint your picture. First of all, how did he turn his campaign around?
Well, partly because he ran a bad campaign. He's really uncomfortable being initially ran a bad. He was the front runner. He was the establishment candidate. McCain is a maverick. He's an outsider. He doesn't like being the front runner. In fact, it'll be interesting to see how he does now that he is one again, the heir apparent. And he really wasn't comfortable, and he ran a bad campaign, and they squandered a lot of money. And by summertime, his obituary was being written. Well, that consigned him to being a maverick. That's what he likes. He likes it out there on the outside looking in, and he ran a brilliant insurgency.
Well, some have also said that he may have been saved by that meltdown because talk show hosts didn't bother to make a case against him. By the time they did, he had surged. But let's talk about why it is that those on the right, you know, hate him so much. I mean, there's this, they paint him as a liberal, but, you know, McCain hasn't he tacked to the right on so many issues of late?
Not so much. He is a conservative. He hasn't had a tack. He was there to begin with. Occasionally, he's reached across the aisle and dealt with some dangerous liberals like Teddy Kennedy. And, you know, so, and the conservatives don't like that. What they sense about McCain is that he's independent. He's not doctrinaire. He has no problem telling off conservative talk show hosts or conservative senators. And not only that, he enjoys it. He takes a certain glee and pleasure in being unorthodox, and that to the priesthood that keeps conservative orthodoxy, that's heresy.
Well, let's tick through some of the issues. Perhaps either move to the right, or as you said, always been on the right. But issues like immigration, some would say he tacked back from his call for reform. Waterboarding, he was one of the strongest voices on Capitol Hill arguing for clear military standards for treating prisoners or in interrogation. But just this week declined to vote for a bill that included a provision that would have restricted the interrogation techniques of intelligence agencies.
Yeah, the last one surprised me a little bit. He's not above tacking a bit. A year ago, when he was trying to get the establishment votes, he was pandering a bit to the right wing. So although he's, relatively speaking, relative to other politicians, pretty much of a stand-up straight guy, he's not 100% because, well, frankly, in politics you can't be and become president.
Ticking through a few more, on the Bush tax cuts, he originally opposed them. Now he vows he'll make them permanent. But stem cell research, he's been steadfastly taking a position that conservatives abhor.
Right. I mean, again, he's not doctrinaire. He will tack a little bit for political, but he's mostly, and again, this is all, the baseline here is what politicians normally do.
Right.
The baseline is sort of Mitt Romney, who's all over the place. Maybe that's the extreme. That's not the baseline. That's the poll. But in any case, he's a more consistently independent stand-up guy than most politicians. Nonetheless, he does a little bit of maneuvering as he deems fit.
Yeah. Just to tick them off as people are wanting to know, because it's interesting. We've been saying on this program that it's possible that many voters really don't know John McCain stands because he's been so positioned as a liberal by conservative talk show hosts. But he's also committed to appointing judges who will overturn Roe v. Wade.
Right. I mean, one thing that, and you're doing it on this show, one thing that's going to happen is that there's a certain romantic aura around McCain, that he's the independent and all that, and that makes independents cross over or vote for him in open primaries. And, of course, as we get closer to November, he's going to be defined in places like Massachusetts as the conservative as he really is, and people are going to be reminded on this show and others that he's going to do things that liberals really don't like appoint Supreme Court justices who are going to be against Roe v. Wade. That's going to happen. I think that a lot of voters, though, not as many as right now, but a lot of voters will still sense that McCain on some issues will not be doctrinaire.
Well, we want to take a quick break, and when we come back, talk about one in particular, his view of war. Here's John McCain in April of last year speaking to an audience at a VFW hall in South Carolina. He was asked by a man about the threat from Iran.
But having been a critic of the way this war was fought and a proponent of the very strategy now being followed, it is my obligation to encourage Americans to give it a chance to succeed. To do otherwise would be contrary to the interests of my country and dishonorable.
That, of course, is John McCain speaking about Iraq, not Iran. We'll have his singing about Iran when we come back. We're talking with Evan Thomas, editor-at-large for Newsweek magazine, and we'll continue our look at John McCain in 1 minute here and now. We're getting a profile of Arizona Senator John McCain, the Republican frontrunner in the race to the White House. And we're getting that profile from Newsweek editor-at-large Evan Thomas, who's just written a cover story on John McCain. And Evan, let's talk about the war in Iraq. John McCain stands in stark contrast to the Democratic frontrunners on his thoughts about how long troops might be there. Remind us.
He's talked about 100 years necessary. But there's a slightly bogus quality to this debate. The Democrats are talking about 6 to 12 months out of there. McCain's talking about 100 years. But once, no matter who gets elected, my own view on this is that they're going to be constrained, and the Democrats aren't going to be able to get troops out of there as fast as they would like. And McCain, for all his talk about 100 years, is going to be under pressure to get some troops out of there. So my guess is that a year after whichever president's inaugurated, doesn't matter which, you're going to have not 150,000 troops, maybe, but maybe 80,000.
Well, let's talk about McCain, the man, because that part of the profile is fascinating. And we read in your article things that some people may not have heard of. so angry as a child, as a toddler, that he would hold his breath until he passed out and his parents would have to throw him into a bath of ice water to revive him.
Yeah, that's in his memoirs. I mean, he was, you know, you can sense today. You sit across from him, as I did in a hotel room a couple weeks ago. You can feel that anger. It's still there. He was a rebel in high school. He was a very entertaining rebel. He was, you know, in a fancy private high school, he was known as a punk and nasty and McNasty.
And why was that? Tell us more about that.
Well, he came from this military family, and while his buddies were going to go off to loll around Princeton for 4 years, he knew he was going to the Naval Academy. No choice. He had, as he puts it, he was on leave from the Navy when he was in high school. And so he reacted by rebelling. Now, but it's a special kind of rebellion. The thing about McCain is he always knows where the edge is. He graduated fifth from the bottom of his class at the Naval Academy, but, you know, he knew where the edge was, and he was careful not to go over it. He's the same way as a politician. He'll flirt with danger, but he won't go all the way.
Well, what about the famous temper? And you write about that I'm paraphrasing you, but you write at one point that here's a fellow who can be so prickly and vindictive. He's exactly the kind of military martinet whose finger you would not want to be near a button.
He can be. I qualified that. He's also somebody who's full of forgiveness and grace.
And forgives his own captors after, you know, he was a POW.
Right. You have to keep both of these sides of him in mind. Look, like the rest of us, he has many sides of his personality. It's a little bit more dramatic in his case because of what he's been through. He's been through experiences that the rest of us just can't imagine. And I don't know what he's going to be like if he's elected president. Are we going to see the forgiving side, the tolerant side, the ability to reach out and listen to others? I think that's in there. Or are we going to see this petty and vindictive and sort of impetuous side that pops up from time to time?
When, in fact, you know, it's left a trail in Washington. I mean, he's, you know, made many enemies.
It does. But one of the things about that is he doesn't suffer fools, and he's surrounded by fools up there. I mean, the people he tells off tend to be pork-barreling senators. And it's sort of, in some ways, a good thing that one of their peers does challenge them. Now, maybe they shouldn't do it with obscenities as he's done in the past. It's sort of healthy that somebody is blowing the whistle. It's just that he can sometimes do it in a too personal way.
He has a complicated family life many Americans might recognize. His first marriage did not survive his experience in Vietnam. He's had two marriages, seven children, including a child adopted from Mother Teresa's orphanage in Bangladesh. That child was falsely portrayed as the child of an illicit affair in that ugly 2000 presidential race. In many ways, though, it's a close family and maybe more modern than some of the others that are out on the campaign trail, but it seems close and tight-knit.
Yeah, I think so. I'm sure we're going to find out more, because we always plunge into the personal lives of candidates, and we'll probably find out things about the McCain family that, you know, are less attractive, just as they would find out about pretty much any American's family. It's hard to know how people react to that. Sometimes people are sympathetic because, as you say, it's familiar. Sometimes they feel that there's hypocrisy because a guy like McCain's a pretty big moralist. I really don't have a good feel for how that's going to play. The press can be counted on to pick up the rock and see whatever is going on in that guy's family. We're going to find out about it. And I just don't know how it's going to play. My sense is that he's an honorable guy. His kids love him. He's got one in Iraq right now. I'm not saying that I sense any trouble there, but I'm sure the press is going to go digging.
Right. We're talking with Evan Thomas. And just filling out our picture of John McCain, you wrote the cover story for Newsweek magazine. Did you like him?
Oh, yeah. I've known McCain for years. I'm like a lot of reporters. He has a lot of friends in the press. I'm one of about 1,000 who feel warmth to him, and I've had meals and been out late at night with him and all that, and he's a thoroughly likable guy. That doesn't mean, however, that the press is going to go easy on him, or that I will, because there are some questions about his character.
Well, and the other candidates, whoever they are, may not either. We just were mentioning earlier Barack Obama. They have a hostility that goes back a couple of years. John McCain went so far as to call Obama disingenuous. On the other hand, there's a story of John McCain and Senator Hillary Clinton having a vodka drinking contest while traveling.
Yeah, that's classic McCain. I mean, he's a very disarming guy. And he can loosen up anybody, including Hillary Clinton, who's actually a lot looser than she seems on the campaign trail. That story doesn't it's amusing, but it doesn't surprise me too much. The chemistry between Obama and McCain, though, is interesting, and you can see, as you've more accurately forecast, McCain is getting ready to go after Obama for being too much of a dreamer, and how Obama reacts to that is going to be very revealing.
Right. Evan Thomas, editor-at-large for Newsweek, as we said, just written a cover story on John McCain. He's also the author of several books, his latest, Ships in the Night, Four Naval Commanders, and The Last Sea War. Evan, we'll have to have you back for that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob.
A quick look ahead. Monday on Here and Now, whether it's President McCain, Obama, or Clinton, the newly elected president is going to inherit major challenges, two wars, a looming recession at home, we'll outline. We'll also look back through the history books with Julian Zelitzer to see how newly elected presidents have coped with challenges. One example, Richard Nixon in Vietnam. That's Monday. Still ahead today, though, we turn it over to you, your letters. Back after the news, Here and Now. We begin our next story with a caution that while health officials feel strongly that parents should listen and talk to their kids about it, parents may not find it appropriate for kids to listen right now. It regards a deadly game that kids call the choking game, the fainting game, or space monkey. They strangle themselves, cutting off the oxygen flow to the brain, hoping to get a high when the blood flow and oxygen returns, but sometimes it does not return. It is not urban legend. Here's part of an actual 911 call in California, and again, we caution, this is very disturbing.
Okay, why do you think he's dead?
Because he was over at his neck, guys, they were bunked out, and he's all purple and stuff.
Okay, how old is your brother?
13, we're twins.
You're twins, and he's 13, too.
The Centers for Disease Control released a report this week that says there were 82 deaths from this dangerous game between 1995 and 2007. But even the report's authors say that figure is probably too low, and our guests probably agree. Dr. Tom Andrew is the chief medical examiner of New Hampshire. He's been studying this for several years. Dr. Andrew, based on what you've seen in New Hampshire, you think the real number of deaths from this choking game might be more like 100 per year.
Yes, I don't think the numbers are astronomically high, but this is a good starting point.
Well, we're also joined by Sharon Grant of Toronto, Canada, who knows way too much about this story. Her 12-year-old son, Jesse, died playing the choking game in 2005. She's now on the board of an organization called GASP, Games Adolescents Shouldn't Play. There's a link at our website, by the way. Sharon, first of all, we're so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And to help us understand this, could you just briefly tell us what happened to Jesse?
Jesse was an A student and basically into every athletic thing that you can imagine. Hockey was his real favorite. But the thing that happened to Jesse was he learned it at camp with a whole bunch of kids who thought it was extremely fun to do this. Mm. When I spoke to him, which he told us about because he didn't think it was bad, when I spoke to him, he thought that I was just overreacting. And as usual, they tell you, well, I'm not doing it anyway, Mom. And he's just typical of most of the children that think, because they learn it in groups of children, as a fun thing to happen.
Yeah. Was he with a group or alone when he died?
He was alone. Most children are alone.
Yeah.
They use mechanisms with belts and cords, and they think that they're going to release, and they don't release in time. And
yeah,
eventually, some of these kids are going to die because it's not going to release.
Dr. Andrew, we understand some kids are choosing this, thinking it's safer than drugs. From a medical perspective, what exactly is happening to these kids? I mean, cutting off the blood flow, then what happens?
When pressure is applied to the neck, whether it's some other kid's hands or a ligature if the child is playing alone, what that will do is temporarily steal blood flow, if you will, from the brain, because you're damming up or you're not allowing blood to escape through those thin-walled blood vessels, the veins in the neck, and the brain becomes sort of engorged, and you get this lightheaded feeling that's perceived as a high by the player of the game. And then when the pressure is released and blood flows out of the brain and arterial blood flows up into the brain, there is this sort of rush. So they get two sensations for one experience. And again, like you pointed out, they've been deceived into thinking it's safe because they're not using a drug.
And we should say that the CDC report that I mentioned doesn't include cases where it's not clear whether a death of a child came from this choking game or suicide. There may be parents who are thinking that their child committed suicide. It might be this game.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think the reason it's so hard to gather data is that some of these cases may well be misclassified as suicidal deaths when they are in truth accidents. But Sharon pointed out, I think, a very, very important feature. The profile of the victims of this kind of activity is very different from youth suicide. These children are high-achieving, action-oriented kids.
Mm-hmm.
They are kids that kind of fly under the radar as being, quote, troublesome.
If I could just add something, the parents along with these children have this sense of, my child's not in trouble because he's a good kid.
Sharon, you say you knew your son was playing the game. He talked to you about it, and you talked to him, you know, you told him not to do it. When you think back, were there signs or the things you tell parents, you know, to look for to know whether a child is playing the game?
There were signs that I didn't recognize. The big one being that he had talked to someone about losing brain cells, which are very important to these overachievers. The other thing is the bloodshot eyes and the headaches.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of months before Jesse died, the headaches started, and I just thought, you know, growing pains or a flu. And then their personality changes to be a little bit more aggressive.
And as we said, you now are, you know, one of the experts on this and join many other parents who are sharing stories. We understand if there are ropes, scarves, or belts tied to bedroom furniture or doorknobs or found knotted on the floor, that could be another sign.
Definitely.
Dr. Andrew, so what do parents do? I mean, 20 years ago, we've been talking about this, news organizations wrestled with whether or not to report these stories for fear of creating copycats. So what about parents? Should they talk to their kids, or will that put ideas in their heads?
Well, let me be abundantly clear. I just did not for a minute buy any kind of Pandora's box argument on this. The kids know about it.
We understand they can see about it on YouTube.
That's exactly right. And to take a sort of head-in-the-sand approach to this is lunacy. You have to treat it like you would treat any other high-risk behavior in this age group, and that is present information in a calm and rational way. No one hesitates to talk about drugs, alcohol, tobacco, and sex with this age group anymore, and this behavior should be treated the same way. It's dangerous, it's got definite risks, and this is what could happen.
And Sharon Grant, we understand it can also be addictive. I mean, there may be an intervention called for. Do you agree?
Oh, yes. We've had many people that have asked for help that we can't help them with, that have been doing it since they started at 12 and 13 years and are now in college.
We should say that the CDC in its report also didn't count deaths that might have involved autoerotic asphyxiation. That is another form of self-strangulation during masturbation. So this is, as kids get older, there are other techniques. Sharon, if there's one thing you could tell a parent right now to help a parent have that conversation with a child, what would it be?
The first thing is to take them to somewhere like a website, whether it's our website or another website, but not YouTube.
Yeah.
To take them to a website to show exactly what the numbers are. All those families that lost someone, they can understand immediately what it's doing to them and what the results will be if they did it by themselves.
Right. And doctor, would you recommend medical help for parents who fear they're not breaking a child of this game?
That's certainly in order. I mean, you would certainly seek help for a child who you thought was into drug-seeking behavior. While I don't hold myself out as an expert in addiction medicine, I do think there may be an aspect of that in this, and you would treat it in exactly the same way.
That's Dr. Tom Andrew, Chief Medical Examiner for the state of New Hampshire, and, of course, Sharon Grant of Toronto, Canada, whose 12-year-old son, Jesse, died playing the choking game in 2005. We'll have links to websites with more information at our website, here-now.org. But, Dr. Sharon, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And one more time, the name of her group is GASP, Games Adolescents Shouldn't Play, and we'll link you again to their website at ours, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. It It's been a while, so let's take a few minutes to hear some of your thoughts. After the last Democratic presidential debate, we spoke with New York Times television critic Alessandra Stanley about the historic pairing of a black man and a woman and the water cooler response it provoked the next day. We heard questions like, when Barack Obama pulled out Hillary Clinton's chair, did he look subservient to her or did she look less powerful? Connie Ortiz of Cornelius, North Carolina, wrote us to say neither Obama nor Clinton is her candidate, but she found the whole conversation distasteful. But Mark Golombiowski of Chicago had this thought: as for the holding of the chair by Obama for Mrs. Clinton, it only shows that chivalry is not dead. He was just showing good manners. Well, Bruce Weinstein, who writes the Ethics Guy column for Business Week magazine, would have discouraged any day after talk about the debates at work. He took part in our segment on political talk in the workplace and said it can get too heated and can affect the bottom line. Well, Bob Bell of Laurinburg, North Carolina, disagreed. He writes, outside of work, my social circles typically don't include African Americans, Latinos, Asians, or people of other diversities. So if I'm going to get another viewpoint, work is the only place where I can get it, and I'm glad I'm curious. Well, in that segment, Bruce Weinstein wouldn't just ban politics in the workplace. He would ban talk of money, sex, and religion. And many of you had an opinion on that. Here's Doris from Leonard, Michigan.
There is a coworker of my husband's who, on the bottom of his email, adds a religious reference. And I just find it very inappropriate. And I agree that that should not be part of the workplace dialogue.
But Cherie of Amherst, New Hampshire, had a very different experience. After a colleague forwarded her one of those false Barack Obama emails, she called her up.
And we had a great discussion back and forth about it. And I think since this is a democracy, that it is our place as Americans to have these conversations and discuss candidates and viewpoints and how things affect us.
And Caroline Wood of Bozeman, Montana, doesn't want political talk officially banned, but she said it probably isn't a good idea anywhere.
My mother was actually called aside at her book club because my father wrote a politically charged editorial opinion in our local newspaper, and she was called out on it by her book club that, oh my goodness, she was not sharing their political beliefs. And it made it very, very uncomfortable for her to return and to be around those people when they had always had a wonderful time together prior to this.
And one last comment on our politics in the workplace story. We also spoke in that segment with author Bruce Barry, who said in many states, employers have the right to fire a worker for their political views. You may remember he gave the example of a woman let go because she had a John Kerry bumper sticker. Well, Stuart McCaw wrote, okay, so who was it? I don't want to put money in the pocket of an individual who would do that. Please tell us the employer's name. Well, Stuart, Lynn Goble was fired by EnvironMate. It's a company that makes insulation. Bruce Barry writes about that and other cases in his book, Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. And a couple of quick shout-outs for you. We want to say hello to Aaron and Shanti Woolsey, listening online at 7 in the evening in Gaborone, Botswana. She's a doctor with the University of Pennsylvania Botswana Partnership Program doing outreach at local hospitals. Aaron writes, I cannot tell you how very comforting it is to hear your familiar voice here. Well, Aaron, you are a comfort as well. And Major Sergeant Hugh Jumpstead, U.S. Air Force, wrote from Fort Dix, New Jersey, giving us an excuse to play Genesis. He writes, in your review of the new Levon Helm album, you were talking about other drummers who were singers. You mentioned Don Henley. How about Phil Collins? How about them?
Just as I thought it was going all right, I found out I'm wrong when I thought it was right. It's always the same, it's just a shame, that's all.
How about your thoughts on anything on the program? Our address is letters@here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. Or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. When we come back, hip-hop artists are asking, has hip-hop gotten too cookie-cutter? Back in 1 minute with that, here and now.
Where I could leave, but I won't go. It'd be easier, I know. I can't feel a thing from my head down to my toes. So why does it always seem to be? Be looking at you looking at me. It's always the same, it's just a shame.
2007 was a tough year for hip-hop. According to the music industry tracking service Nielsen SoundScan, hip-hop sales have fallen 30% since 2006, the largest decline in any genre. Only one hip-hop record, Kanye West's Graduation, was among the top 20 best-selling albums of last year. Take this, haters. That don't kill me, can only make me stronger. Now critics and fans are wondering, what's up with hip-hop? Here in Al's music critic Christopher Blagg explores the reasons behind the freefall.
Everyone in the music industry is asking the same question. What's wrong with hip-hop? Some point to the rise of digital sales. Others cite changing tastes in its core audience. But what isn't talked about much is quality. A cookie-cutter mentality consumes the genre. Originality isn't rewarded, it's crushed. The same three or four producers are creating the same beats for everyone. Lyrical content rarely rises above the omnipresent bling-bling. And on albums, more emphasis is placed on inane skits than songs. Just listen to one of the year's big hip-hop singles, Soulja Boy's Crank That. Sounds more like a ringtone than music to me. Good hip-hop is still being made, but it's mostly relegated to the underground. Toronto's Chaos has managed to be both multi-platinum and innovative. He's a superstar in Canada, but has attained only cult status in the U.S. He blames his genre's decline on the follow-the-leader mentality.
There's a chain of prerequisites that go now with this startup kit that goes with being an MC or rapper. I'm sure the same goes for rock and roll, but I'm sure bands like Weezer or Kurt Cobain was like, I'm not going to do that. The intelligence still falls upon the artist to transcend that trend.
Breaking out of that startup kit can be difficult. Issues of acceptance and identity plagued Chaos when he first started branching out.
In my case, there was a lot of angst and fear because as a black person, as a person, an ethnic person, as a Trinidadian person, as a person of color, there's a certain swagger, speech, rhythm that I was supposed to subscribe to. And when I decided to step away from that, the fears in my blood and in my persona were kicked up because I was like, is this black music still? You know, I'm using these guitars. Is this that? If you want to be able to call yourself an MC, then you have to take chances.
How's this for chances? How many times do you hear a tabla and an acoustic guitar in hip-hop, as in this live version of Valhalla?
Yo, check it out. In the name, we were all born in a flame. Not the same, but under the moon. On a desert plain, we roam home. Keep coast ghost. I saw it with my naked eye way too close now. I'm just the son of the man on a mission who worked with his hands and brought in the foreign land in the hinterland. Holding the mic like an axe with the bit, yo.
I don't think the risk in itself earns you a badge of success or honor. I think the love behind the risk you take. I mean, I'm a Billy Joel fan. I'm a Paul McCartney. I love Wings. You know what I mean? That's a risky thing to say as a hip-hopper. You know what I mean? So it's like, I'm an Elton John fan. You know what I mean? So it's like, to me, it's like, but I can't hide that.
These schizoid influences pop up all over Chaos's records. Check the gospel funk of Crab Bucket. Now, why isn't this on the radio?
Clock strikes 12, clock strikes 1. Smoking gun, put these fools on the run. I know it's not that simple. I know it's not that hard. Where's your
trying to get down, but I'm moving up. No time to get down, but I'm moving up. No time to get down, but I'm moving up. Take off the grass in the bucket. No time to get down, but I'm moving up. No time to get down, but I'm moving up. No time to get down, but I'm moving up. Take off the grass in the bucket.
While we may be struggling through the dark ages of hip-hop, there was a golden age in the late 80s and early 90s when diversity and originality reigned. Back then, Afrocentric groups like De La Soul and Tribe Called Quest Pop acts like Kid and Play and socially minded powerhouses like KRS-One ruled the day. Standing tall above them all was the politically explosive juggernaut of Public Enemy, whose records stood out both sonically and lyrically. Its frontman Chuck D personified the risk-taking ethos of the era.
We got the pump, the stuff, the major talk. From the heart, it's the start of work of art to revolutionize, make a change, something strange. People, people, we all the same. No, we're not the same, because we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. You say, what is this? My beloved, let's get down to business.
25 years ago, because you didn't have so many groups like you have today, the big goal was to create your own niche, and so therefore the name of the game for artists coming in back then was to carve your own identity, create your own niche, and to be different from any other artists out there. Today, the artists are forced to be similar, and those artists that take chances are maybe quickly lopped off because they're not given a chance to develop.
The courage to experiment, to broaden your musical palette, that's what's missing in hip-hop today. The romanticized thug themes are wearing thin on today's audiences. Chuck D lays most of the blame on the money-grubbing methods employed by the major record companies. His disgust permeates his new record, How You Sell Soul to a Soulless People Who Sold Their Soul.
Check this out. Damn, if I be some slave again, got no fake-ass friends and no Timbs or rims. Showing up, got no designer names, and I never played no video games. And I ain't got no diamond rings, no bling, and no mix, and no two-air rings, and no pimp glasses, mugs or cups and things, or whatever the hell they all be carrying. And
my point is I'm critical at the powers that be, and I'm critical at the way that the structure allows for a substandard to exist, not so much in the art of somebody making a song. It's just that, you know, they promote the goal of getting the money instead of working for it. And so there's a lot of laziness that's going on.
Today, there are more one-hit wonders in hip-hop than ever. If you look at the list of rap artists who've stuck around, it's the ones who are constantly changing, taking risks, being the squeaky wheels. Kanye West, Outkast, Common, Jay-Z, even Snoop Dogg, they all went their own path instead of following the herd. But it can't be easy going out on a limb, a feeling that chaos can relate to.
Growing up amongst our peers, we always had the term brother different. In the black community, there's always a brother different. You know, a guy who dresses different, he wears different colors. And that guy kind of always looked upon, kind of weird, but you kind of respect him too because he doesn't really care because he's doing his thing. I think I always fit into that category.
The growing popularity of websites like MySpace and YouTube may point towards a more diverse and independent solution to hip-hop's sagging popularity. For now, it must be tough trying to stay afloat in a sea of flashy clones.
That's what makes art exciting. I just think people are more embracing that when radio had more of an opportunity to respirate, when a DJ could go, I'm going to play this Prince record, I'm going to play this Radiohead record, I'm going to play this Nirvana record because I love it and I went to a club and all my friends are digging it and we want to expose it to the world. Now it's like I go to radio stations and there's a computer in front of me and the list is already picked. You know, that's life. That's where we live right now.
Okay, it seems at times that I'm under hypnosis. I suppose this city life is a process. I wrote this like a million years ago. Tried to get out of the game a million tears ago, but I'm back, chilling, illin' for top villain. Levitate to the ceiling by resurrecting the feeling. Hip-hop, it started out in the park. Are we lost in the dark? I think we maybe forgot, but never mind.
Hip-hop artist Chaos speaking to Here Now's music critic Christopher Blagg. We'll leave you with the Chaos song, Flypaper. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
My antimatter is shattering any ladder that's crawling with snakes. Make no mistake, we not fake. Wake up. I'm not one to repeat myself, but if it ain't broken, don't fix it. I see you burning all that midnight oil, but I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. That's why I'm walking in the city with a hard face. Seems I'm afraid of being afraid.